ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Selena Green, again with you today. In a moment, well, there's a big push, as we know, for new large-scale renewable energy projects here in South Australia. But what about the rights and interests of landholders and pastoralists, in particular with these rolling out? More on that in just a moment. Also, continued frustration over the hold-up in right to repair laws for farm machinery.
Really, our farmers can't get access to the information, spare parts and tools that they need to fix their tractors when they break down. They're really forced to go back to authorised repairers.
That is to come. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with me throughout the program, 1300 222 891 and the text line is 0467 922891. There's also just been announced an extension to the no fishing zone along the southeast coast due to the spread of a virus that's killing abalone. I'll bring you more on that in the second half of the show today, so stick around for that. But you would have been hearing a lot lately on South Australia's big push to develop and get investors into large-scale hydrogen and renewable energy projects. And the government's recently passed new laws, the Hydrogen and Renewable Energy Act 2023 to be specific, that will, amongst other things, help identify government-owned land and waters where renewable energy projects can be hosted. And that includes pastoral land. A Livestock SA says it's been advocating on behalf of producers with the government on this, and in the coming week it'll host some workshops for those who want to know more about how this might affect their business. I spoke with Livestock SA's CEO Travis Tobin to explain what they'll cover.
Yes, Selena, I guess it's a follow-on from what we did working with the Department of Energy and Mining ahead of the Act. So we had a really good producer and broader pastoral community session in Port Augusta ahead of the Act, and I think the department got a huge amount out of that as far as what people are wanting to see and why. And this is a similar approach, only perhaps more important because, you know, as you'd be aware these days, a lot of the details in the regulations, not necessarily the Act. So the 2 half-day workshops on the 12th and 13th of March, again in Port Augusta, it is really about working through the detail of what will be in the regulations. So the actual legislation that that determines how things happen.
So if you've got pastoralists out there who are a bit unsure about how this is going to impact and what this essentially means, this will be a good chance for them to wrap their head around that?
Yeah, so we haven't seen the draft regs ourselves, so but I would anticipate that anyone attending the workshop will receive information prior to it, whether that's the draft regulations or a lot of information letting them understand what's going to be discussed at the day. But there's a whole series of things happening with this legislation, and besides an update on what is, you know, what the Act does and where the regulations are at, you know, they'll need to seek input from the release areas, the tendering, the licensing, the agreement, environmental management, you know, those sorts of things from producers and, as I said, the broader pastoral community. So it's a pretty important that information, not only for producers and the community to understand, but also for them to have their input.
Have you been hearing concerns, or have there been concerns raised at this stage by producers about what this could mean for them?
Yeah, so ongoing, I guess we've had a number of issues that we're really keen to make sure are included in regulations. And as I said, we've been working closely with the department right through this process, so we'll hopefully see that come through. So I guess from our perspective, we look at it through a few different lenses. Like the first one, obviously, first and foremost, is ensuring that producers are engaged at the right time in all these processes. They can get the support that they need. So, you know, in negotiations, you'll be looking at potentially multinational companies dealing with family businesses. So there's always that unlevel playing field issue you've got to deal with. Making sure they're properly compensated for disruption. So, you know, these facilities, the development of these large renewable energy facilities can take several years to complete, and, you know, they'll occupy vast areas of land. And the other one for the producers is really being able to negotiate beneficial profit share or other income generation agreements, you know, that helps them deliver a more robust business model. You know, because these projects are essentially harvesting solar and wind resources that nobody owns by way of a permanent imposition and interruption to their business. So they're sort of from a producer level. From at an industry level, we're really keen to ensure biosecurity responsibilities are embedded and enforced, and associated infrastructure such as, you know, new poles and wires for transmission don't have negative impact on adjoining properties or such, like we've seen in other states such as Victoria. So at an environmental level, we obviously look for the checks and balances to make sure there's no degradation there and actually we get net positive environmental benefit. And then the other one that more broadly that we look at is the regional community development. So this is a signature government policy that, you know, we're told is going to be the creation of a new economy, and it's been likened to SA's gold rush. So those benefits must be delivered to the regions. It can't all just flow back to Adelaide. And, you know, an example, we were talking a few weeks ago, Selena, an example comes immediately to mind is, you know, 10,000 kilometres of outback roads network that's currently grossly underfunded. So that's sort of the lens that we look through all this at and what we're hoping to see come through on the regulations.
Well, Travis, you've got this workshop coming up in the following week. Who would you really like to see there for? Who is this mainly for?
Yeah, Selena, I guess it is mostly geared towards pastoralists, so producers and the broader pastoral community, which is why it's in Port Augusta. But any producer who wants to come along should, or anyone with an interest in it. The reason it's there is just because the government is focused in the Upper Spencer Gulf at the moment. So, but more broadly, we know this is a real government priority. And, you know, if you look at the recent announcements where the government's looking to become net zero, 100% renewable by 2027 instead of 2030, now, so they've brought that forward 3 years, I suspect there's going to be a fairly keen to get development occurring as soon as possible. So it's really important that the regulatory settings are right. So we encourage all producers to attend so they can have their say and understand what it might mean for them.
That is CEO of Livestock SA, Travis Tobin, there. That Hydrogen and Renewable Energy Act Pastoralist Workshop, it's being held at Port Augusta next Tuesday and Wednesday, and more details are on the Livestock SA website. Now, the state government has announced that consultation on the new regulations under the Hydrogen and Renewable Energy Act 2023, well, they actually started yesterday. That act passed the South Australian Parliament in November last year, and the supporting regulations establishing those is the final step in that legislation process. So the consultation on those regulations, as I said, it opened yesterday. It runs for a 6-week period and submissions are invited until Monday the 15th of April. You can find all the details for that on the Your Say website, yoursay.sa.gov.au. It's 13 minutes past 12. Well, Aussie grain prices have been on the slide this year and a lot of growers are now very reluctant to sell. Selling has almost come to a standstill in many regions across the eastern states. So what's causing the price to fall and is it smart to hang on to grain? Matt Brand spoke with market analyst Nick Crundall.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I suppose it boils down quickly to there's a lot of stock around the world that needs to move. So if you look at wheat, for instance, Russia and Europe are both sitting on large stocks. And they've both got new crop coming in June, July. So they're kind of racing against the clock to move that stock into the market before that new crop arrives. And the only way they're able to do that is by, you know, ever moving their prices lower to attract more and more demand. So we've got a really, really competitive export market. At the same time, global demand is not particularly strong, and therefore put all that together and we've had prices falling for some time now.
And Nick, I'm told Aussie growers are very reluctant to sell at the moment. Is that a good move?
Look, it all comes down to your risk management. You know, it's not a market, given how much it's fallen, that we would suggest people should go and panic sell everything. However, there is no guarantee that prices can't move lower. You know, we are still on a historical sense at quite attractive levels, and there is still downside risk. So we don't suggest that growers should hold everything back waiting for a rally. At the same time, you know, we don't really want to go in and panic sell. It's just about making sure you've got a few sales on to protect yourself if prices fall further from here.
This lack of sell-in, and I've seen it described as basically at a standstill, is this normal?
It's relatively normal when you get such a severe move in the market lower. Ever since harvest, we've seen prices fall, say for ASW, a feed quality wheat in Victoria, fall to the tune of about $40 to $45 a tonne. So there's been a really, really severe fall, and it just takes the market a bit of time. Growers typically have to come to market to generate some cash flow. Exporters start getting exports on and then have to come to the market to cover those exports. And we do start seeing some trade occur. But in the meantime, it's not unusual to see markets come to a pretty much standstill in these sort of conditions.
Meanwhile, the number of cattle on feed in Australia has increased to a record high in the December quarter. We've got the graph here. If you're a grain grower, what should you make of this?
It is a positive for grain growers who are holding stock to see such high cattle on feed numbers. However, while this was all happening, the market knew that cattle on feed numbers were at a record. We've seen, you know, the Queensland wheat market fall $100 a ton. So it's not a big enough input as an isolated bullish input to get the markets to kick from here. However, it does show there is domestic demand for grain. And again, there is going to be a level where the market's going to find support. It's not going to keep falling to zero. So there is a lot of demand up north, but we need a few other things to go right for the market to see a rise in prices from here.
Nick Crundall there, CEO of Market Check, speaking to Matt Bran.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, more than 18 months after right to repair legislation passed for the motoring industry, still not being extended to farm machinery, and an expert researcher says that's not good enough. Since July 2022, car manufacturers have been required by law to share service and repair information with independent repairers, but there's no such requirement when it comes to farm machinery. That means farmers and their independent mechanics are locked out of repairing machines, so when breakdowns happen, machines must be repaired by the manufacturer or an authorised repairer. Professor Leanne Wiseman's chair of the Australian Repair Network at Griffith University, and she says despite federal authorities highlighting the need for farmers to have the right to repair, it still hasn't happened.
Some of the challenges that we're seeing with repairing ag machinery has really been identified by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and the Productivity Commission, is that there's really serious competition concerns in the agricultural machinery aftermarket in Australia. And why this is that really our farmers can't get access to the information, spare parts and tools that they need to fix their tractors when they break down. They're really forced to go back to authorised repairers of the manufacturers. But a lot of these farmers are diesel mechanics. They've got the skills and knowledge. They've always been tinkering with their tractors. And it's just that these tractors are now software enabled that they really don't have access to that software. And that's really what the barrier to repair is for ag machinery.
And you must hear a lot of frustration over that when, as you've said, a lot of the time farmers have got the skills to do the repair work. They've paid hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for these machines and they can't repair what can often be pretty minor issues with them.
That's exactly right. So what we're seeing and we're hearing from farmers all around the country is the fact that they've always been able to change a sensor or a filter or whatever it might be on their tractors. But now, because they're so sophisticated with the software that's embedded in them, if they try to do anything with their tractors, they potentially either will breach their warranty or basically, the machine will be bricked. It won't work if they try to tamper with the software. So this is really causing such a challenge for them. The industry is no different to, for example, the automotive industry, and we've just seen Australia's first right to repair law being passed last year. because our independent mechanics were in that same position. They could not get access to the information that they needed and the diagnostic software that they need to fix our cars. And everybody always thought that they'd have to take their cars back to the dealer or the authorised manufacturer to get those warranty or service and repairs. But it's recognised it creates such a competition issue to deny independent repairers that information. And with our farmers, as you say, their diesel mechanics, their fitters and turners, they're all really high skilled, and they've been doing this for decades. They should really be able to fix their tractors.
Is there any reason why that legislation around right to repair in the automotive industry can't be extended to farm machinery?
No, that's a very good point, and that's exactly what the ACCC and our Productivity Commission has said, both in their inquiry reports in 2021. We have a scheme. It's governed by the ACCC. It's got teeth. It's working for automotive repair. We just know that agricultural machinery and heavy vehicles have been excluded from that scheme from its introduction. But it's already been indicated that there may be that scheme should be revisited to include agricultural machinery. And we're not seeing any movement from the equipment manufacturers to be more open and transparent with their repair and diagnostic information. They have the opportunity to share this information with farmers and independent repairers, and that's actually not happening. So if it's a case that we need to regulate, we've really got all the recommendations sitting there, and we have a scheme that will work for agricultural machinery.
So is what's required political pressure then, organisations like the Victorian Farmers Federation, to be pressuring the federal government to extend this right to repair legislation to farm machinery?
Yes, look, even speaking here today at the VFF Grains conference about the right to repair ag machinery is a really important step. We know that both Fiona Simpson, the former president of the NFF, and now David, current president of the NFF, that the NFF has a policy to support a right to repair for agricultural machinery. So we really need, and we hear it from the farmers all the time, we really need that political will to take that up to the federal government and for the government to respond by including ag machinery into that mandatory scheme.
The answer to this might be obvious, but why don't manufacturers grant right to repair to farmers?
Well, the manufacturers use a number of arguments. They say it might impact on their intellectual property over the machinery. Arguments around safety and security are raised. Certainly, we know that there is a very valuable repair and service aftermarket, and there's a lot of money being generated by restricting competition in that market. So a lot of the repairs that we're speaking about, and we've seen this issue addressed throughout the world, is that a lot of the repairs that we're talking about that farmers should be able to do are not infringing any IP rights or safety or security of those vehicles or machinery. Therefore, those arguments really aren't valid, in that it's more about protecting their markets and the money that they're making in those service and repair markets.
And you talked about some good international examples of what you think should be done in Australia, having already happened.
In Colorado, there's an agricultural machinery right to repair specific piece of legislation. So farmers who are denied access to what they need to fix their tractors have the ability to take that matter up with their Attorney General. There is 20... also proposed pieces of legislation around right to repair in the United States. We know in Europe that farmers do have access to the diagnostic software and the parts and tools that they need. So it's really, given Australia's geographic and climactic challenges, the distances and times that farmers have to wait for authorised repairers to access their farms, sometimes it's 2 or 3 days, it's really time for Australia to recognise that the inability of farmers to repair their tractors is really hampering the food production and ultimately food security in Australia.
And why hasn't the legislation been introduced? Is it a political reason, or is it just that people haven't got around to it?
Well, the recommendations have sat with the federal government in 2021, and then we had a change of government. And I think there's just been some time delays in recognising those priorities. But I think Australian agriculture, with its goals of reaching 100 million at the farm gate, really needs to make sure that they can keep their farmers farming, but keep their machines moving as well.
That was Professor Leanne Wiseman, who's chair of the Australian Repair Network at Griffith University, and she was speaking there to Angus Verley. It's 24 minutes past 12. This is the South Australian Country Hour. You're with Selena Green today, and it's time to head to the Weather Bureau. Our forecast today is Mark Analak. Hello, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena. How are you?
Very good. What's the story across South Australia today?
Well, in the last 24 hours, we had some thunderstorms pop up over the far west of the state, and that dropped 38 millimetres of rainfall over Nullarbor. 22 millimetres of that fell in pretty short time in that 1 hour between 11 and 12 yesterday. So some very heavy rainfall and with the thunderstorms out in the west yesterday. For the rest of the state, it's been mostly dry, really, a high-pressure system dominating the weather. And for the rest of today, while we are expecting showers and thunderstorms again out in the far west of the state, the sort of central and eastern parts should remain dry again. At the moment, temperatures are starting to rise. Cooper Pedy's already up to 38 degrees, but generally across the state, we're seeing temperatures climbing into the low 30s around now. Down the southeast, Mount Gambier's still sitting on about 28 degrees, but dry for the rest of the afternoon. Maybe a little bit of high-level cloud drifting across agricultural areas, and showers and thunderstorms about the far west later this afternoon and evening. Those thunderstorms could be severe again, so keep an eye out this afternoon for severe thunderstorm warnings that may come through later this afternoon for those thunderstorms. Moving into tomorrow, look, there's very little change to the pressure pattern, really, so I expect very similar conditions. Dry across much of the state, but we can expect some showers and thunderstorms again about the far western parts of the state. I would say probably west of about Ceduna would probably be our best chance of picking up a thunderstorm. And the closer we get to the Western Australian border, probably the higher the risk for severe thunderstorms again tomorrow. Moving into Thursday, a high-pressure system, again, still dominating the weather, so we're likely to see winds start to move easterly, push any activity out further towards WA, so that we're looking at a mainly dry day on Thursday. Friday, winds start to turn northerly, temperatures start to rise, and again, another dry day forecast. Saturday, at this stage, we'll see those northerly winds bringing in some very warm conditions, it looks like Saturday will be the hottest day of the week, with temperatures getting up into the high 30s, low 40s across the state. Very dry conditions and a little bit of extra wind in those northerly winds will be a little bit fresher as well. So elevated fire danger ratings for the weekend at this stage. Keep an eye out for that. But after that, things tend to settle down a little bit, and we're looking at mainly fine conditions for the early part of next week. In terms of rainfall amounts, most of the activity will be about the far west of the state, so we're looking at showers and thunderstorms producing areas of 2 to 10 millimetres west of about Ceduna to Cooper Pedy, 10 to 30 millimetres more sort of closer to the western border, and these severe thunderstorms this afternoon and tomorrow afternoon may produce localised falls of 30 to 50 millimetres each. So pretty wet conditions out in the far west of the state, but for most of your listening area, we're looking at dry across South Australia.
All right, thanks, Mark. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Mark Analak there from the Weather Bureau. Now, having a look at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, it's a very similar story for both the upper and lower western district, both expecting a mostly sunny day with northeast to southeasterly winds around 15 to 20 k's an hour, tending north to northwesterly around 15 to 25 k's an hour. Early in the morning in the upper western district and then closer to the middle of the day for the lower western district. And for the lower western district, those winds will then tend southeast to southwesterly around 15 to 20 kilometres per hour by the early afternoon. Overnight temperatures, well, for the upper western district, they'll be in the low to mid 20s, closer to around 15 to 19 degrees for the lower western district. Both districts are expecting the daytime temperature to reach into the mid to high 30s. It is coming up to 12:30 here on the South Australian Country Hour. As promised, in this next half an hour, some more detail on the extension of fishing restrictions across the southeast coast with some further developments in the spread of the AVG virus that has been killing wild abalone off the coast. So that no fishing zone that was from the Victorian border to Nene Valley has now been extended. There's also a buffer zone all the way up to the Murray mouth. You'll get more detail on that in just a moment.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Hi there. So yeah, in just a sec, I'm going to get you some further details on some new restrictions that have just been announced today. Along a large section of the South Australian coast in a bid to slow the spread of a virus that's killing wild abalone. Also today, the problem with a lot of introduced invasive species is not just the damage that they cause, but the fact that some of them are just so darn cute. So how do you take something cute, like a little rabbit, and teach children why they're something that needs to be wiped out in the wild?
The problem is if I drew a rabbit, it would probably look quite cute, and we didn't want the rabbits to come across as cute either. So if I've referenced the rabbits, it's usually been a quick little silhouette or the damage they've done.
It's a new children's book that's just been launched here in South Australia, trying to find that balance of educating young ones about the dangers and the damage caused by invasive species. And some of them, as I said, unfortunately, they're pretty cute. So how do you do that? Well, you'll get that story soon. This is all After News headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the federal government has approved health insurance premiums to rise by 3%. Late last year, the health minister rejected a request from insurers to raise them by 6%. The change means the cost of health insurance will rise on April the 1st. Restrictions around fishing in the state's southeast will be eased from midday but extended westward to fight the spread of a virus affecting abalone. Abalone viral ganglioneuritis was discovered near Port Macdonald last month. And the MFS has rescued an elderly couple who were found unconscious in a burning home in Adelaide's northeast last night. Emergency services were called to a Modbury address shortly after 8 p.m. with reports of a single-storey house on fire. The couple in their early 80s were given CPR by police before being rushed to hospital. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman there with your headlines. So yes, as you just heard, there's been a development in the spread of a lethal abalone virus detected for the first time in South Australia. Abalone viral ganglioneuritis, or AVG, was first detected in dead and dying wild abalone close to the Victorian border last weekend, and an immediate ban on all fishing was put in place along the coast to Nene Valley here in South Australia. But as of midday today, that control area has been extended to South End, placing some strict regulations on fishing in that wider area. The Department of Primary Industries has also put in something it's called a buffer zone between Southend and the Murray Mouth. Nathan Rhodes is PIRRS's Executive Director of Biosecurity. I had a chance to speak with him a short time ago and asked him to explain where this new extension covers.
Yeah, so the extension now goes from the Victorian border up to Southend. It previously finished at Nene Valley, but that's now been extended from the Nene Valley point up to Southend. And that's because of more information that we've learned over the course of this response that gives us concern that the abalone viral ganglioneuritis disease may have spread further than we originally thought.
Right, so there has been, since that first detection announced last weekend, you've been doing some further testing along that coastal area?
That's right. So what we did, once we set that control zone, is we got out on the water as soon as the weather permitted, and we took a number of samples from the western edge of that existing control zone back towards the point at which we detected that virus. Running those samples through the labs over the course of that week, we found that there were a low number of positive detections at all of those locations along the coast that we sampled, and including right up against the western boundary of the control zone. So the concern for us there is that we know that we've got virus at the boundary of our control zone, and we've got modelling that we've developed over the course of the response that gives us cause to be concerned that maybe the disease is, has progressed further than we thought.
Those restrictions now that carry from the Victorian border through to Southend, just remind us what that includes, what you cannot now do in those waters.
Yeah, so it has changed slightly, and this is part of us beginning to understand the situation better. We have to take a conservative approach initially when we don't know what's going on, but as we've got more information, we can start to refine some of those decisions based on the risk that we are beginning to understand. So what we've done now is that extension through to South End, you're still not allowed to fish for abalone or rock lobster, and basically any activity that involves interaction with the sea floor. That's where this disease is, and so we just want to make sure that those interactions don't spread the disease further. So as I say, abalone and rock lobster fishing, you know, reef diving and spear fishing or using anchors presents a risk of spreading the disease, so those things remain prohibited. What we have been able to ease is things like line fishing, where you might be dropping, you know, baits and sinkers, etc., to the bottom. We're comfortable that those things present a lower risk now, and so we have been able to ease those restrictions.
What if I do catch something line fishing, though? Can I throw it back, or do you have to keep it?
If you accidentally catch a crab, you know, and when you're line fishing, then we would, in the control area, we would ask you to put that back. Normal finfish, etc., is fine. That's okay to keep.
With the restricted area with no fishing, there will be obviously some rock lobster fishers who have pots in that affected area, that extended zone now. I know previously there was some workaround for them to be able to retrieve those and decontaminate them. Are there any plans at this stage for fishers to be able to retrieve pots in that new area?
Yes, that's right. Look, we don't want pots to get caught up in that situation again, and so we have put in place a provision whereby rock lobster fishers will have the opportunity to get out and collect those pots within the first 48 hours of this extension taking effect, and that will be subject to the same conditions that we have in place currently for the previous control zone, where once you collect those pots, you need to remove any obvious contamination from them, whether it's, you know, seaweed or marine life or any of those sorts of things. And then take them back into shore and clean them in an area where the runoff's not going to run back into the sea, and apply detergent, etc., which would neutralise the virus.
Now, Nathan, aside from the extension of this no fishing zone to South End, you've also put in a place something called a buffer zone, and this extends what, right up to the Murray mouth. This is also new.
Yes, it is new, and that's something that is part of us beginning to understand what management of this disease might look like. This disease is not going to be eradicable from South Australia, unfortunately, and so we will have to put in place measures in the longer term that allow us to manage the presence of this disease. Now, the buffer zone, we have no suspicion at this point in time that ABG has spread that far, but we are encouraging people to use good biosecurity practices in that area, and they're basic hygiene measures to ensure that we don't spread that disease further. So fishing activities like rock lobster and abalone fishing is still permitted in that buffer zone, but we just ask you that people decontaminate that equipment after using it. Likewise, you are allowed to keep your catch from rock lobster and abalone fishing. You can consume that, dispose it on land, or you can return it to the buffer zone. And you can also use anchors and those sorts of things in that area as well. So it's much, much lighter restrictions in the buffer zone.
Right, and that buffer zone, that's from South End, as we said, to the Murray mouth.
That's right.
Yeah, and does that apply for both commercial and recreational fishing in that buffer zone?
Yes, it does. Mm. That's right, yes. All sorts of fishing that present those sorts of risks of spreading the disease.
So if now it is, I guess it is in South Australia, and if it's not eradicable, if it is now a management phase for this virus, what is the next stage? What is the next plan? Because obviously if you've got areas where fishing is completely off limits, that's not going to be a long-term solution.
Not at all, no. So what we're doing is like we have with the original control zone, we are closing up to South End and undertaking some significant surveillance as quickly as we can, and we'll be out on the water with the cooperation of the commercial abalone fishermen to undertake some more surveillance all the way from South End back to Nene Valley. Now, that'll tell us a lot about the presence of the disease there, and what I'm really hopeful of is that we don't find any evidence that ABG is in those areas, and we can then consider reducing the size of that control zone quite quickly. What is important, though, in these situations is that we control as many variables as we can while we develop our understanding. And we do that by putting in place these restrictions. And while they're inconvenient for people, they are necessary for us to try and minimise the movement of the disease until we can understand its spread and the management measures that we need to put in place. So longer term, I would hope that we're in a position where we have access to the water and we have very minimal controls around where we can and can't undertake these benthic activities.
This is a big area, obviously a very popular area for fishing and not just recreationally but commercially as well. How are you going to go about monitoring and policing all of these restrictions? Obviously there will be some expectation that people will do the right thing, but you know, will there be some extra surveillance as well?
Yeah, there will be. So obviously we have our fisheries officers network from PIRSA. Everyone will be familiar with PIRSA Fisheries, and they are active in the region at the moment around the boat ramps. And they'll continue to do so, particularly over the time when we're out there doing our surveillance and we've got these closures in place. So they understand what is and isn't allowed. There are penalties for not following these requirements, and our fisheries officers will be there, not just applying penalties, but also helping inform people about the restrictions and the things that they need to do to comply.
That was Nathan Rhodes speaking there. He's the Executive Director of Biosecurity with PIRSA. And all of these details, if you want to double check what is and isn't allowed and where, this is all on the PIRSA website, pir.sa.gov.au/AVG. And anyone who is feeling overwhelmed by this situation, and it is affecting fishers from a number of industries along that area, you are encouraged to contact a family and business support member. For those in the Limestone Coast, that's Sally Close, and the number is 0427 829 143. It is 19 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. You're with Selena Green. Rabbits can be very cute, but wild introduced rabbits are an absolute pest when it comes to the destruction of crops and the native environment. So how do you go about teaching young children that something so adorable is something that needs to be exterminated in the wild? Well, one way is through story, and Caroline Horn has this report.
It's a tricky thing to have to do. To write and illustrate a cute picture book to be read by very young children that tries to teach them that introduced European wild rabbits need to be exterminated for the good of the Australian environment and native wildlife. But that's the aim of the newly launched children's book, Banjo Frogs Concert Spectacular. In the book, the Easter Bilby travels to a town set in the landscape of the Fleurieu Peninsula, intending to watch a concert. However, he arrives to find all the animals are too tired and too hungry to perform because the wild rabbits have eaten away their habitats and sources of food. So the Easter Bilby and the other animals then head to the local school and ask the children to write a letter to their parents, asking them to remove the wild rabbits and plant native trees, shrubs and grasses. The book then ends with the bonk bonk sounds of the banjo frog as the concert goes ahead amid newly planted seedlings. The book's been commissioned by the Foundation for Rabbit Free Australia. Mount Gambier-based artist Bianca Richardson provided the illustrations, but the job of finding just the right words was given to Kristen Martin, an author, children's poet and Year 1 teacher at Fulham North Primary School in Adelaide.
Michael from Wakefield Press actually approached me. I'd met him a couple times and I had pitched him something for adults, but he knew me as a children's poet and he still hasn't got back to me about the adults project. But he said, haven't got to that yet, are you interested in this? And I said yes.
So what was the brief?
So it was to get the message across about the damage that rabbits cause and what we can do to undo that and to show how they affect the native animals.
I noticed that, and I'll come over to you here as well, Bianca, with the illustrations. There's no pictures of any rabbits in the book. That was a deliberate thing?
Yeah, that was a deliberate thing. The problem is if I drew a rabbit, it would probably look quite cute, and we didn't want the rabbits to come across as cute either. So if I've referenced the rabbits, it's usually been a quick little silhouette or the damage they've done.
So the message is to ask parents to take the rabbits away. Have you had questions from kids about, well, how does that happen? Or, you know, was it hard to sort of think, how do we word this?
There was a lot of discussion, a lot of back and forth, because I said, well, I couldn't even say get rid of the rabbits because a student got upset when I, my trial read to a few year one students, a student got upset. And I said, we can't even use the words get rid of the rabbits. It's a children's book. So I said, we asked the adults to remove the rabbits and we don't need to go there because that's for adults. that's not for children, I don't need that discussion. Someone else can deal with that, not me.
And it focuses on what could be, what life will be like for the other animals if...
Yeah, if there's no rabbits around, how their life will be much better.
The book was officially launched last week at the tiny 36-student school at Rapid Bay, about 80 kilometres south of Adelaide, with Kristen reading the book to the children.
Who can tell me what is this thing?
House.
It's not a house.
It's just
a
petrol station.
Oh, it's not a petrol station. It even says it. It says S-C-H-O-O-L. It says school, but it is Rapid Bay Area School. Can you see it up there?
Yeah.
It's your school in a book. Isn't that exciting?
Chairman of the Foundation for Rabbit Free Australia, Professor Wayne Meyer, also attended.
We're trying to raise awareness about the need for ongoing rabbit control and starting, obviously, at a very early age, and then hoping that that awareness will carry on through as kids become more aware of the damage that rabbits do across the country.
So why pick the hills of Rapid Bay and the Fluorio Peninsula as a setting?
Rabbits around on the Fluorio continue to be a major problem and, in fact, seem to be increasing. And the other is that this is an area with a small school that is undertaking some revegetation around their area. They need to be aware of the need to control rabbits so you can be successful in your revegetation efforts.
And so the picture book, obviously, it's going to raise funds. But also, is it a way through the kids to try and get to the parents, some of them who might be new to land holding or, have smaller land holdings in the area?
That's exactly right, because obviously children have a very big influence on how their parents think and perceive things. The other thing we're doing with it is it's trying to get a series of books over the next few years that deal with different areas around Australia, because each area has got, particular kinds of vegetation and particular wildlife that are being affected by rabbits. So you try to get a book which is local to the area, specific for their plants and animals. And if we can do that, and we'd also like to get some of the books into Indigenous languages so that we raise that awareness as well.
That was the chair of the Foundation for Rabbit Free Australia, Professor Wayne Meyer, ending that report from Caroline Horn at the launch of the book Banjo Frogs Concert Spectacular. Keep an eye out for more on this on the ABC News website.
Here's my top footy tip for the season. You can get your games live and ad-free on the ABC Listen app.
That's insightful!
I know, right? AFL, NRL, men's, women's. Whatever footy you're after, we've got you covered.
Kicks him over the line, he does, he bounces it through.
Every goal, try, mark and tackle. Called by ABC Sports expert commentary team.
How did he do it? Game, set, bingo!
This season on the home of 100% pure footy, the ABC Listen app.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green with you for the Country Hour today. Well, Australia's reliance on imports is being blamed for a national shortage of sliced beetroot that's been frustrating consumers for more than 6 months. Have you noticed a bit less of it on your supermarket shelf? Well, people searching for the perfect addition to a homemade burger have been consistently met by empty spaces on the shelves where canned beetroot used to be. Jennifer Nichols explains why.
Head to any supermarket and it's likely you'll find the canned beetroot shelves are stripped bare. Customers could be confused as to why, when Australia's beetroot production increased by 10% last financial year to 16,167 tonnes. While you can still buy fresh beetroot, hunting down sliced beetroot for a homemade burger has been a challenge. As soon as any hits the shelves, it's gone, like toilet paper at the height of the pandemic.
Right from the 40s through to this year, I'm unaware of another time that there's been a shortage of beetroot like this.
Based at Cowra in New South Wales, Ed Fagan's family has been farming in Australia since 1886.
Started growing beetroot during the Second World War.
Mr. Fagan says the shortage of processed beetroot can be directly linked to a decision by American multinational food company Kraft Heinz to stop canning beetroot at its Brisbane-based Golden Circle factory in 2011, 3 years after purchasing it.
It's a direct result of companies going offshore. Australia has a very wide growing area for beetroot from Tassie right through to Queensland. And they decided, you know, Heinz, which owns Golden Circle, decided to go to New Zealand where they grow everything on the, you know, on a postage stamp sort of area.
In February last year, Cyclone Gabrielle caused so much damage with flash flooding and landslides that New Zealand's beetroot crop is only now starting to recover. Ed Fagan says Kraft Heinz's decision backfired.
So, you know, you get a flood like they had and it wiped out basically the entirety of their crop. That would be a very rare problem in Australia. You know, Heinz is now owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett. He's no fool. And, you know, their direction is that they want to concentrate on their main core business, which is Europe and US. So what they're doing down in New Zealand does not fit into that model. So it's been for sale for well over a year. And you have to question the motive for moving offshore in the first place. You know, they're looking for cheap labour and, you know, cheaper production and everything else. But obviously it hasn't been a major success for them because they're trying to sell it.
A Kraft Heinz spokesperson did not respond when asked about continued speculation. The company plans to sell its food manufacturing assets in Australia and New Zealand, including its pineapple cannery in Brisbane. They did say that Golden Circle beetroot will be back in store in the next few weeks, building to normal supply over the ensuing months. Most of Australia's beetroot is grown in Queensland's Lockyer and Fassifern Valleys and the Sydney Basin. Ed Fagan's beetroot harvests go directly to long-established Australian family-owned company, Three Threes.
And it's worked really well, very different to the corporate partnerships.
Founded in 1919, it's now run by fourth-generation food manufacturer Michael McAlpine and his wife Justine.
My great-grandfather used to be a conductor on the trams in Sydney. In 1919, he made the decision to pull up stumps and go and sell the mustard pickles, which his beautiful wife used to make and all his fellow mates loved. So they said, oh, you need to go and sell that. He went and started selling it by horse and cart. And the same mustard pickles is still out there today, so 105 years later.
Mr. McAlpine says Golden Circle stopped supplying tinned beetroot in July last year, and all sliced Australian beetroot has been coming out of 3-3's Lidcombe-based factory in Western Sydney and Edgell, owned by the US-based privately-owned company Simplot.
We've had significant increase in sales, and we've replanted and managed to keep that going, but Edgell have ran out, so now it's just ourselves to supply the whole of Australia. And we're doing the best we can.
A Simplot spokesperson said the 2024 Edgell Australian-grown crop was looking great and is anticipated to be back on shelves in late May. Andrew McDonald from advocacy group AusVeg told ABC Rural that as a net importer of tinned or processed vegetable products, Australia is often at the mercy of international supply chain factors when it comes to the supply of some product lines. He says Australia's strength is its national vegetable supply chain and an ability to produce most commodities year-round, and the tinned beetroot shortage highlights the need to ensure Australia has sufficient food manufacturing and processing capability to meet domestic need. Michael McAlpine says everyone would benefit if more people adopted the practice of supporting Australian-grown and Australian-made products.
Our beliefs is always supporting Australia whenever possible. So we buy all Australian glass, we buy Australian machinery where possible, and we just support Australia first and foremost. So we're very proud of making sure that we pack Australian product where we can. It's important to us.
Michael McAlpine says there isn't a level playing field between Australian-made products and imports.
At the moment, on our current rate, every 5 years we're paying $1 million in land tax. It's cruel when, you know, European companies and their farmers are getting subsidies. Our farmers get nothing. They're beautiful people. They work so hard, but it's like you've got to have your fingers tied behind your back and work away and compete against the imports.
That there was Michael McAlpine from 3-3 speaking with Jennifer Nichols. And there's been a huge amount of interest in this story on our website. You can hop on and read the story right now on abc.net.au/rural. There's a lot of great stories there from the ABC Rural team from right across Australia to check out while you're on that website. Well, finally today, here's a big question. Is organic stone fruit tastier? Some customers think so, reaching for organically grown peaches, apricots, plums. But Producers still have to control weeds and insects, so how can they do that and still make a profit? Renee Kretschmer runs a biodynamic orchard at Wirrabra in the southern Flinders Ranges and says that biodiversity in the orchard is key to that. She spoke to Kate Higgins about how their biodynamic orchard works.
Our farm's been certified biodynamic about 25 years now. My parents got that. And really, it's the enhanced method of organics. So, of course, we don't use any sprays or herbicides, no chemicals on the fruit, no fungicides, as a lot of commercial orchards do put out. So, yeah, for us, we do lose probably more fruit from things like fungal diseases than commercial orchards. But the product is, what we've been told, is a bit higher quality. It keeps for longer. There's actual real flavour in it. It's not just pumped full of water or artificial fertilisers. But yeah, we do the biodynamic 500 preparation that's put out as a mist sort of spray in the orchard 2 times per year. Okay. This is the composted cow manure. People sometimes know of it as the like horn manure or 500. Composted cow manure, which has been buried in cow horns over winter, and that's pretty much like a soil enhancer. So it's got a lot of microbes in it, and that activates the soil. So, yeah, the trees are getting their nutrients, I suppose, from the soil life. And it's pretty amazing when you see a tree with, you know, 100-odd kilos of fruit on it and you realise that you haven't put any fertiliser or anything creating it from, I suppose, what it's finding in the soil.
The orchard has what you would expect. Apricot, peach, nectarine, plums and other types of fruit and nut trees. But there are also many different animals, and in particular, the geese, ducks and guinea fowl, which are routinely rounded up by the orchard's kelpies, are one key method of weed control.
I suppose for us, around this area anyway, we've got probably about 50 geese, and they're sort of like the orchard sheep, so they keep the grasses and weeds down. And then, yeah, got ducks out in the orchard. I've got a lot of guinea fowl running around. And then, yeah, it's like brush cutting around the trees. That gets done probably 3 times or so after spring. Lots of slashing. And then we've got a few like ride-on mowers where you can really get quite close and underneath some of the trees a tractor doesn't get under. So it's a pretty constant thing to keep slashing.
Diversity of plants, including planting native trees, not only improves the soil quality, but also attracts birds to control fruit-eating insects.
All through the orchard, there's random areas of native trees along all the fence lines, shelter belts we've got in. I mean, that's a bit more of a protection for the animals and the trees from the wind that comes through. But otherwise, it's just adding diversity to the orchard, and that's to improve the soil and provide a different food source sometimes for all the birds that come in. It's always improving the soil if you've got like the living roots throughout, and specifically in the orchard, it's just a diversity of root trees, so they're not competing for nutrients. You've got the native trees in, they're providing habitat for the birds. It's another method that we use for organic like pest control. It's encouraging the smaller native birds in, and they're eating the insects, and the other insects, I suppose, are predating on the ones that we don't want around here. You know, I think the best thing that really we can do is continue to add diversity to the orchard. That's something that Dad's been doing since for the last 20 years or so, is planting different varieties. So, you know, if there is a bad weather event which comes through, it'll wipe out that crop, but we might have apricots which are ripening every 2 weeks for a few months. So, you know, the ones that aren't ripe, they'll be all right. And then you've got different varieties of fruit. So we've got the peaches. There's 8 or 10 different varieties there, and they're all ripening different times. Same with the plums. Yeah, we're just sort of always adding new varieties, trying what's suited to, you know, more erratic weather or more wet weather that comes through.
The orchard cattle and sheep also love the fruit. The Kretschmers sell their meat at local markets, with some customers telling Renee they can taste the difference. While Renee isn't sure whether fruit changes the taste of the meat, it does make for happy animals and reduces any wastage from spoilt fruit.
We just got a small herd of cattle, got about 20 or so at the moment, and sheep I've got about 100, and we raise them like for meat, sell at the local markets, and they're such a beneficial animal to have for fruit growers because they love fruit. Any like fruit which isn't saleable, you know, it's got a big bird peck in it, or it's just far too small to process every day. We'll take out a few buckets and the cows and the sheep, they definitely know about it. They hear the bike start up and they'll start bellowing.
That's organic fruit grower Renee Kretschmer there speaking with Kate Higgins. That's it for the Country Hour for today. I'm about to hand you over to the 1 o'clock news, and then after that you'll have Nikolai Balhartz for this afternoon's program. You may have noticed that there's been a big rise in non-alcoholic drinks lately. 0% alcoholic beer and wine. Seems to be a lot more options on the shelves these days. But apparently now some parents are a bit confused about whether or not it's appropriate to let their teenagers drink these non-alcoholic drinks that look alcoholic but don't have any alcohol in them. So Nikolai is going to explore that on the program for you this afternoon. It's news time now though. It's just going on 1 o'clock.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.